the same way in defense of my stance regarding it being like Rasulullah. I think that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sent prophets in human forms rather than metaphysical creatures like angels,
mm-hmm.
because we can't relate to that, right? And if we were to imagine the holy month of Ramadan as an entity, it would probably be a person, or like the brother said, like straight up a light, a beam, or a great glowing orb of light, because we just can't pin it. We can't imagine anything else. It's either going to have limbs and eyes and ears and nose like a normal human being, or it's just going to be like an obscure ball of light or shining brightness, because we can't imagine anything beyond that. Even if it's just light, I think we would interpret it as such because we associate light with calmness and purity and all those lovely lovey-dovey fuzzy feelings that we get inside, and it's tranquility and it's clear and it's clean and it's nice and it's safe, you know, and it's all those wonderful wholesome feelings that we experience during the holy month of Ramadan. So yeah, definitely either light or human being, it's nothing other than that.
As Brother Eamon was talking about or referring to, we are mostly in touch with all the time with this kind of human form, because it's something which is what we are used to most often, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's why we normally tend, or we normally think of the other things, even as metaphysical being or reality as they might be, to something which is human form,
exactly.
Anthropomorphic, basically.
Exactly.
All right. Since we were talking about the month of Ramadan, and we try to compare it to or liken it to something of anthropomorphic reality or entity, how would you, in fact, describe the characteristics of such a person or personality, like through the month of Sha'ban and when we are approaching the month of Ramadan, and you may hear the footsteps, in fact, of the month, this month of God coming to us,
yes.
How would different limbs and bodies or body parts of this month be to you?
I think I would say that, since we are shaping, we are imagining this month as a human form, there are many different reasons for this month. There are many reasons that we fast in this month. I think the very most important reason is that we are very much concerned while we are looking at things.
Yes.
We are very much concerned when we are speaking or listening. So we like to refrain from the prohibited things in this month, you know, like with pure attention. That we don't want to see anything bad, we don't want to listen anything bad, we don't want to speak anything bad, we don't want to touch anything which is, you know, prohibited. That's one thing. And the other thing is that, you know, when you, I think that comes to mind as well, that in this month, since we are hungry from sunrise till sunset,
yes.
You know, people who are rich, who are well-fed, who have food on their tables, they are also hungry for that period. And they, you know, I think become, you know, more concerned with the fact that there are many poor people on this earth who don't have food on their plates, right?
Yes.
So this understanding gives them such a notion that they become kind to others. They become the ones who give food to other people. They start giving food to other people.
Being more empathetic rather than sympathetic.
Yes, yes, exactly, yeah. So you know, I think this notion would probably, you know, come to our minds as a form of, you know, Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
Ramadan is a existence which is very kind,
yes.
to others, and very, very refraining from the, you know, prohibited acts.
I see. Sister Zainab, but what about the effects of such a personality on you when Ramadan leaves us? This is an important thing.
All right, because the religion of Islam is constantly emphasizing on the fact that you cannot preach what you you cannot act contradictory to what you're preaching, right? You can't preach what you don't practice, basically. I feel that if the month of Ramadan preaches us, we are already imagining it as an entity. Preaches us to be charitable, to be kind, to be sympathetic, to be merciful, to be forgiving, to be hopeful, mm-hmm. To be, you know, basically, it highlights every human value. It tells us to, during those 30 days, be the best version of yourself, right? So it has to be the best version of a human being. Again, that's why I said it would look like Rasulullah, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, because he's the best version of human beings. And because of that, I would imagine, and if I could imagine a lifespan for the holy month of Ramadan, I would say that it was a newborn during, like, Rajab, and then it through the month of Sha'ban, it was in the prime of its youth, and during the month of Ramadan, it's like its maturity, and it's like a whole mature, intellectual, complete, perfect person now. And it would have kind eyes, you know, very watchful, very, very wakeful, and very aware of the things that are going on around it, because during the nights of Ramadan, we're meant to supplicate. During the days of Ramadan, we're meant to refrain from seeing things that are, like, not suitable or inappropriate and stuff like that. So I imagine that's the kind of eyes that the person, the human form of Ramadan would have. And it would obviously have dry lips because it's thirsty, and it would have open-palmed hands all the time because it's constantly giving, and it'd be very well-dressed, and it smell really good. And if I could imagine it as a person, I think it would be a very lovable-looking person.
Appealing. Okay, thank you very much, Sister Zainab. Thank you, Brother Eamon.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, dear audience, for listening to us, to your program, Back to Reality on RIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. On the 10th day of Ramadan, the loyal and unmatched wife of the Prophet of Islam, Lady Khadija, passed away. During the pre-Islam era, she used to be called Tahire, meaning spotlessly pure, as she was very chaste and pious. She was known as the master of the women of Quraysh tribe. She was also famous as a very wise and foresighted lady among the Arab people. Lady Khadija was very rich, hence she was also called as Malikatul Arab, or the Queen of Arabs. Some of the researchers maintain that she had got married before marriage with Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, but others, like Ja'far Murtaza Ameli, are of the opinion that the Prophet of Islam was the first and only husband of Lady Khadija, peace upon her. This great lady was a refuge for the needy and the destitute even before Islam. Lady Khadija generously put her entire wealth at the service of the Prophet and the cause of Islam. The Prophet described her, saying, Khadija believed in me when others denied me, and accepted me when others rejected me, and rushed to help me with her wealth when others deprived me, and God granted me children through her that He didn't grant me through any of other wives. Lady Khadija was very kind toward the Prophet. When the Prophet entered the house, she would welcome him and sympathize with him. She would dust his face and tell him soothing words to alleviate the hardships that he had sustained from the polytheist. Ibn Ishaq, the first writer of the history of Islam, writes, "The Prophet would not hear any denial or saddening word from the disbelievers unless Lady Khadija would alleviate it. She would accept him and consider the insults of people as unimportant." All of us know that lying is one of the worst sins and is the source of many other sins. This sin deprives us from the divine mercy in this world and the hereafter. Lying also causes people not to trust us. According to the Islamic narrations, lying is the key to other sins. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "Telling truth is invitation to doing righteous deeds, and doing righteous deeds is invitation to paradise." The 11th successor of the Prophet, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, also says, "All evils have been put in a room, and the key to that room is lie." One of the things that nullify fasting is to attribute lie to God, the Prophet, and the infallible Imams. It includes verbal attribution or written one. In view of this, a fasting person cannot narrate the statements from the prophets and the imams unless he or she is sure of the narration to be correct. This will nullify his or her fasting. The Prophet of Islam and the Imams of Isa Ahlul Bayt have highly recommended us to be optimistic at the time of praying. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Pray to God in a way that you are certain about its fulfillment." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says, "When you pray, at that moment, think that your need has been met and is ready." Now let us continue reciting another part of Dua Abu Hamza Somali. As we said in the previous episode, this application was taught to Abu Hamza by the fourth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him. "My Lord, had anyone known my sin except you, I would have not committed it, and had I feared hasty punishment, I would have refrained from it. Not because you are the meanest of seers, but because you are the best coverer and highest ruler and noblest of the noble. Where is your beautiful covering? Where is your great pardoning? Where is your near release? Where is your quick response to refugees? Where is your vast mercy? Where are your gracious bounties? Where are your sweet blessings? Where are your ample affair? Where is your great grace? Where is your corpulent bounty? Where is your old goodness? Where is your nobility, O noble? By your nobility, save me, O giver of bounties. I'm not the one to rely on my deeds to be saved from your punishment. Thy rely on your grace upon us because you are the giver of bounties and pardon sins nobly. So we do not know what to thank, whether the beauty that you have spread or the ugliness that you have covered. O friend of anyone who befriends you, an apple of eyes of anyone who takes refuge with you and cuts other bonds for your sake. My lord, is it possible to see you doing against our optimistic wishes in you or frustrate our hopes in you? Never, O noble, my lord. We disobeyed you while we hope that you will cover our sin. We called you while we hope that you will answer us and fulfill our hope. O guardian, indeed, we know that we do not deserve it with our deeds, but we know that you will not expel us from your door, although we are not entitled to your mercy. But you are such that you forgive us, O forgiver. By your light we were guided, and by your grace we were became needless. And with your bounty we spend our day and night. Our sins are before you, O God. We seek forgiveness for them and return to you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
We get people.
DMX Life Lessons.
American rapper and actor DMX recently died at the age of 50 after decades of struggling with crack cocaine addiction. Born L. Simmons in New York in 1970, DMX struggled most of his life with drug addiction.
I'm tired of lying to myself, thinking I could do it on my own. When I get left alone, the devil peeks in and creeps in, knocks on the door lightly and sneaks in. And it's usually around the weekend that I get reckless and jump off the deep end. Lord, if you hear me, you know that I'm coming to you sincerely. I need you near me. Please feel me. I'm sick and I need you to heal me.
Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi, on We the People. DMX's death has revived the debate about war on drug and addiction in the United States, from the crack cocaine epidemic of the past to today's opioid crisis, which officials prefer not to talk about. In this episode, we'll try to find out what role race plays in all of this. Stay with us.
have patience.
DMX reportedly OD'd at home and was hospitalized for a week until his body functions ultimately failed. According to a hospital statement, DMX died peacefully after he had a catastrophic cardiac arrest. His death deeply saddened his family and fans. He resorted to robbery and violence, just like many other heavy drug addicts of his generation.
DMX spent a significant portion of his life committing crimes, serving time in correctional institutions, and battling addiction. An unspecified overdose ultimately ended his life, but the tragic story of addiction to heavy drugs will be remembered in America. We're now joined by Daniel Shaw, a professor of race, ethnicity, class, and gender at Hostos Community College of the City University of New York. Welcome, Mr. Shaw.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Mr. Shaw, what roles do the Hollywood and the U.S. music industry play in promoting drugs, a point also brought up by DMX himself?
The hip-hop industry, what Chuck D called the CNN of the hood, in its potential to educate and raise consciousness across this country, was hijacked post-1990s. The music industry, music industry magnates, were able to hijack that revolutionary energy and substitute it with something that's completely different today, where misogyny and the rampant abuse of drugs and hyper violence is super glorified.
Many thanks for your insight, Mr. Shaw.
The celebrity's death revived debates about decades of U.S. failure in the war on drugs. Simmons' childhood coincided with a surge in crack cocaine use in major cities across the United States. The surge of the new smokable form of cocaine impacted African-American communities far more than others.
Low-income inner-city neighborhoods where black families were largely located due to racial segregation and discriminatory practices of the time were soon filled with crack cocaine. One victim was Simmons. Although he sold millions of records and was nominated for 3 Grammy Awards, he led a tragic life with suffering. Our next guest is Matt Taibbi, an American journalist and podcaster. He's also the author of 9 books, including 4 New York Times bestsellers. His latest book coming out this year is titled The Business Secrets of Drug Dealing, an Almost True Account. Mr. Taibbi, welcome to the show.
Anytime.
Many thanks. First of all, why are celebrities in America associated with drugs so much?
Well, we've had lots and lots of celebrities who have died as a result of drug abuse. Going back to the 70s, we've had major rock stars from Jimi Hendrix to Janis Joplin, more recently Michael Jackson, Prince. I mean, they all had substance abuse problems. DMX, I don't know how many we've had that have involved crack exactly. And crack is a different drug. It's politically charged for a couple of reasons. Number one, they had this ridiculous sentencing disparity with crack versus cocaine. People are taking drugs not because they're uneducated about what drugs do, but because they have problems in their lives. They have economic problems. They have problems with professional stress. That's kind of the issue with drug use. It's not that people don't know that this can kill you. Of course they know.
Many thanks for your insight, Mr. Taibbi.
The crack cocaine epidemic gave former President Reagan a great chance to take on the African-American community. Large numbers of young black men were imprisoned for long sentences, drug crimes exacerbated, and police brutality against the black community surged, resulting in injury and death for many black men, women, and children.
Drugs are menacing our society. They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions. They're killing our children. From the beginning of our administration, we've taken strong steps to do something about this horror. Tonight, I can report to you that we've made much progress. 37 federal agencies are working together in a vigorous national effort. And by next year, our spending for drug law enforcement will have more than tripled from its 1981 levels. We have increased seizures of illegal drugs. Shortages of marijuana are now being reported. Last year alone, over 10,000 drug criminals were convicted, and nearly $250 million of their assets were seized by the DEA the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Since African Americans were the majority users of crack cocaine, the racist criminal justice system created laws that were specific to crack and found an effective way to imprison thousands of black people. So is it a war on drugs or on African Americans?
This has never been a war on drugs. Since Ronald Reagan, this has been a war on poor people, on black people, on the black community, on the most oppressed communities. I'm actually a few blocks away from where DMX grew up, in Yonkers, in one of the most oppressed, disadvantaged communities. And drugs have destroyed the lives of how many hundreds of thousands of families across this country. And that's actually part of the state machinery or the ruling class machinery in this country.
The U.S. so-called war on drugs is a war many believe is already doomed to fail. Multiple researches since mid-80s show that the U.S. war on drugs has been a failure, with experts arguing that money should be spent on treatment rather than using armed forces to tackle the issue.
This is crack cocaine, seized a few days ago by drug enforcement agents in a park just across the street from the White House. It could easily have been heroin or PCP. It's as innocent looking as candy, but it's turning our cities into battle zones, and it's murdering our children. Let there be no mistake, this stuff is poison. Some used to call drugs harmless recreation. They're not. Drugs are a real and terribly dangerous threat to our neighborhoods, our friends, and our families.
The government-led initiative that aims to stop illegal drug use, distribution, and trade has only resulted in increasing prison sentences. Incarceration of the drug users has proven to be of no use neither for the patient nor the society. What can you say about drug laws in the U.S.?
I mean, there's no question that the drug laws are designed to give police an opportunity to arrest people without means for doing exactly the same things that wealthy people do, but it's permitted in those committees, in those communities. So if you live in a poor neighborhood and you're having a hard time and you fall into the habit of, you know, sort of medicating yourself with any of a number of substances, whether it's crack or heroin or, you know, opiate pills, and sort of in poor white communities, that's a big problem.
The war on drugs began in June 1971 after President Nixon described drug abuse as the public enemy number one. Nixon increased federal funding for drug control agencies and drug treatment efforts, allegedly out of concern for the nation's health.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive. I've asked the Congress to provide the legislative authority and the funds to fuel this kind of an offensive. This will be a worldwide offensive dealing with the problems of sources of supply as well as Americans who may be stationed abroad, wherever they are in the world. It will be government-wide, pulling together the nine different fragmented areas within the government in which this problem is now being handled. And it will be nationwide in terms of a new educational program.
In reality, the war on drugs mostly impacted minority groups, particularly the black communities. Decades after Nixon's war, the African Americans are still much more likely to be arrested and incarcerated for drug-related offenses. The disproportionate effect that the war has had on the people of color is a living proof that the U.S. war on drugs is racist.
Clearly, the drug laws are used as a kind of hammer that the police can apply to poor neighborhoods, particularly inner-city neighborhoods. They're able to use it as a pretense to stop people and search people. These charges, they're not insignificant too. I mean, I think that one of the major ramifications for the drug laws is just that people get into the criminal justice system, and then once you get a record in this country for a significant crime, it's very hard to get back on track.
Crack cocaine is not exactly the most popular heavy drug in America today, but Americans have 1,000 new ways to get addicted. The opioid crisis gripping the country today is one serious issue, emanating from corruption among the most powerful men in the country. Overdose deaths in the United States may have topped 90,000 in 2020, according to some estimates, but the opioid crisis is not getting enough attention due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Yet that is about to change as more and more people die or share their suffering due to addiction.
No police officer has ever helped anybody who's struggling with addiction to combat that addiction. Addicts are sick people. Most addicts come out of an extremely traumatizing social milieu. They have deep PTSD in their own past in most cases, and they're looking for an escape. So putting more police, more repression, and sentencing laws in courts, this is not helping the most marginalized communities. I think DMX embodied this very reality. He is really a young man. He died last week. He was only 50 years old.
Opioid consumption is nothing new, and the rapid increase in overdoses has pushed authorities to find a solution. Some states are hit harder than the others. It was synthetic and semi-synthetic drugs, such as Percocet, Vicodin, OxyContin, and fentanyl, that caused the crisis.
So what do we do about this? Two paths forward, a short term and a long term. In the short term, we need to prevent creating new opiate-dependent patients. In the long term, reform a system that created this. Studies do not support the use of these medicines for management of chronic pain. If you have back, joint, neck pain, do not start these medicines. They don't work in the long term. Medical-assisted therapy helps patients who have developed opiate use disorder, but is a very imperfect solution. It cuts your rate of overdose in about half, but your risk of death is still 3 to 5 times higher if you're on medical-assisted therapy than if you never develop the problem at all.
The opioids were, of course, prescribed by doctors, but apparently their dependency does not let off. As patients fail to get their hands on the drug, after a while, they turn to chasing the dragon, which is both cheaper and more accessible. But how has the public's attitude towards drugs changed today?
The public's attitudes on drugs really haven't changed significantly. In fact, if anything, you could argue that since the Reagan years, we've gone in the other direction. Since the early 90s, we really strongly started to push this new concept of policing. This is broken windows, stop and frisk, community policing, whatever you want to call it, which stressed busting people for whatever they possibly could, which included anything from, you know, sort of public urination to open container laws to the most minor drug laws, even cigarette violations.
Prescription of opioid drugs dramatically grew between 1991 and 2011, along with their potency, and by 2012, 1 in 3 drug users were being prescribed the medicine. How all that came about could offer a glimpse into the way corporations work in America, particularly in the strong pharmaceutical sector. The drug abusers, however, are the ones to suffer.
Using opioids chronically changes your body and how your body handles things. So taking the opioids away is really, really hard. If you have to take the opioids away, I think, you know, you have to argue to do it in a really slow fashion. You have to somehow get the patient on board and get the patient engaged with this process. And you have to try to address the other issues that they have.
Drug companies and the federal government embarked on pushing for prescription of painkiller opioids and ended what they called opioid phobia. The result has been horrendous. As a result, Americans die every day from an opioid overdoses.
There was never a popularization of heroin in sort of upscale white communities. Like that. Of course, it had some users, but in order to really, you know, expand the market, it took the creation of something like OxyContin, which, you know, obviously is not quite as strong as heroin, but it was a different deliverable that opened opiates up to a broad new market. Now suddenly it's everyone from upper class people who have pain problems to sort of working class people in small communities.
The Biden administration has indicated taking a different path. President Biden and Vice President Harris themselves have notorious records on drug enforcement. Decades ago, then-Senator Joe Biden established himself as a sort of drug czar on Capitol Hill. Biden is certainly considered one of the architects of the modern war on drugs.
The president says he wants to wage a war on drugs, but if that's true, what we need is another D-Day, not another Vietnam, not another limited war fought on the cheap and destined for stalemate and human tragedy.
Biden's son, Hunter, has also been struggling with alcohol and drug addiction for years. And for a while, he even had to cook his own crack cocaine. President Biden has proposed mandatory treatment programs as a replacement for incarceration of those in possession of drugs.
Yeah, let's not forget Biden's role in the 1995 war on Black America, war on working class America, when the Clintons gutted the welfare state as we knew it then, which of course impacted the poorest of the poor in this country. So our expectations from Biden are not high at all. He may do this or that patchwork, small incremental concessions, but it won't have any significant impact on what is the pandemic before the pandemic. Opioids across this country take on average about 100,000 lives from us every day.
Even if Biden takes a different path in the war on drugs, he is unlikely to bring about real change. The narrowly divided Congress does not seem capable of passing any major drug reform legislation, although there is a whole lot of potential for change in the executive branch alone.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues to further endanger the lives of vulnerable people, especially people who are incarcerated or use drugs, addressing the overdose crisis is a must. Meanwhile, many medically vulnerable individuals remain in prisons over minor crimes related to possession of drugs.
If you go back and look, you'll find a speech, I think it was on the floor of the Senate a long time ago, where Biden was talking about, I believe he was talking about rave parties, and he was proposing that the government just bulldoze all of them, and when the subject of what law would be needed to do that came up, he said that we should find the rationale. That was Biden's quote, we just need to find the rationale to go after drug dealers. So he's very much always been kind of a pro-prohibition type of politician.
The former president assumed that his proposed wall for the Mexican border could alleviate the crisis by halting flow of narcotics into the United States. He failed to build that wall, and even if he had managed to do so, it would have still been quite unlikely for it to affect the crisis, which has had a disproportionate impact on white suburbanites and rural areas.
We had 761 people die from overdose in our city of 620,000 people. When addiction was something that seemed to affect poor people of color in inner cities, that it was seen as a moral failing, a choice. And therefore, if you made a bad choice and you end up incarcerated or dead, it's your fault. Unless we address these deep-rooted issues, we're not going to really make progress in treating addiction as the disease that we know it to be.
We are joined tonight by Mr. Abdush Shahid Lukman. He is the co-founder of Lukman Nation Media. And I'm glad you're with us tonight, Mr. Lukman, because we're discussing DMX, and there's a narrative out there, and it's pretty powerful, that sees elevated rates of drug usage in oppressed communities. It sees drug usage portrayed in hip-hop music, and it assumes that there is a link between the two. So what can you tell us about DMX, about his life, his music, his struggle with addiction, and about the broader context in which elevated drug use exists in economically and racially oppressed communities?
way. I'd like to first state that music, drug usage, substance abuse has always been part of the entertainment scene. So, you know, so I, you know, I've been, ever since DMX has passed, and it's been made to seem that, you know, DMX was, and he did suffer, you know, substance abuse issues. You know, the way that he rapped, like his style of rapping was like chaotic. And it sort of was like representative of that time. That time period was chaotic. You know, and so, you know, I know some people who haven't like lived through that may see his rap style as being somewhat, you know, maybe comical or, you know, or sort of like maniacal. But during that time, it like it connected with us because not only was our communities chaotic because of the drug trade, and not only the drug trade, but the government's response to that, which I felt was ironic, because it was the government that facilitated that caused this. You know, a lot of your audiences, people know about the CIA's connection to the crack cocaine epidemic. You know, they got a show out called Snowfall that kind of chronicalizes some of that. And you know, how the United States government sacrificed our community in order to fund these covert operations that they had down in Nicaragua. And just basically just sacrificed our community, which was already under stress due to you know, racism and all the negatives that our community was already stressed by, from just discrimination and racism and white supremacy and all those other things. So now you bring this, and you know, look, it was just too much for any community to handle.
Definitely pretty tough to argue with that. But we want to thank you so much, Mr. Lukman, for joining us tonight. We want to thank audiences at home for doing the same. For Press TV's We the People in Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed.
DMX's tragic death at the age of 50 is a warning call for the US government to take serious action. Whether there is a solution on the horizon remains to be seen. Well, that was our show. I'm your host, Mila Javan Magni. Thank you.
Proper Nutrition with Brother Sayyid Vahid Alavi in the program The Month of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum everyone, and welcome back to The Month of Allah. In the last program we talked about the 9 different food items which has its effect both physically and mentally. Food items have its own effect. Now in this program we will talk about another question that is put forth, and that is, how much should we eat? Many of us eat a lot and we excess in our eating, we overeat, and that leads to the body organs getting overworked. And this machine that we call body tries to digest all the food items that we have eaten. And that puts pressure and extra weight on all the organs. And this, in its turn, leads to different diseases. And when you accumulate all these food items within your stomach, you accumulate germs also. and that leads again to other diseases, and you see yourself in an evil cycle. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, the habit of overeating brings a variety of pains and diseases, but we should not excess in not eating either, because we have diseases like anorexia. You have people who are very thin, and that is not something that is recommended either. So Islam is the middle path, and that means the middle path in everything, in all aspects of the human domain and human life. Some follow a strict vegetarian diet, and they just eat vegetarian, they just eat fruits, and that again is not something that is recommended by Islam. So what is recommended by Islam? How should we eat? So what is recommended, according to the narrations, is that your stomach, one-third of it should be filled with food. The second one-third of it should be filled with liquid or water, and the rest should be filled with air. That is the middle path. And again, the message of eat and drink, but do not waste, is a simple message to the humankind, to the human beings. But this simple message has a lot to give to us. This single verse today is ranked as one of the most important healthy diet recommendations to the human being, and is part of the Muslim lifestyle. Now, I will talk more about this, inshallah ta'ala, in the next program, and we will talk more about how to eat the way Islam recommends us, inshallah, to the next program. May Allah's peace and love be upon all of you. Ramadan Kareem.
The light.
In Hong Kong schools, robots are helping children with autism to live a better life. These robots are part of an educational program called Robot for Autism Behavioral Intervention, or RABI. It is designed for individuals with autism between 3 and 18 years of age and aims to make them more social. The robots engage the children with role-playing and verbal interaction, helping them to resolve issues such as conflicts and bullying. The program was developed by a Hong Kong professor, Catherine So. She says the program will help fight social deprivation of a certain group of people.
We would believe that RABI can help them to, you know, improve their social and behavioral skills, and in turn, enhancing their quality of their life. So to reduce being excluded in the society, and also help them to be included in the future.
Catherine says using robots also helps keep the program structured and predictable, as autistic people are hypersensitive to voices and facial expressions. The program she launched in 2015 has now been adopted in more than 20 non-profit groups and public schools in the country. More than 1,200 children have used it so far. A museum in London has transformed its gift shop into a mini supermarket, selling artist-designed food to help an industry largely affected by the coronavirus pandemic. The Design Museum has reopened its shop after the help of 10 artists. It sells essential products with packaging designed by emerging artists. The market offers goods at the same price of normal markets, both online and at the marketplace. The initiative is led by Camille Walala, who says her project is aimed at supporting the artists reading from the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, the project is to support artists, and I think because obviously at the moment there's no exhibition, people can't really show any of their creative work, and it's nice to have like a feedback when you're creative. It's nice to know, you know, if people like your work. I think this is a really nice platform to just bring artwork on like everyday product, and actually people are going to probably come and just buy them and probably keep them as a piece of art, like, you know, an affordable piece of art from some artist that you like. I think it's a really nice way to display art, so yeah, I think.
Well, Malala says the project also conveys the message that creativity is as important for living as the other essentials. She says the creative supermarket will also help the museum, which has seen a drop of more than 90% in income because of the pandemic. The shop is open for just 5 days, but artists expect heavy demand. The worldwide trends show people rapidly moving toward modern vehicles now, especially electric cars. But Parisians saw a very unusual kind of EV driving around the city, similar to the one people were using over a century ago. A replica of the 1881 vehicle by French inventor Gustave Prouve was made to celebrate what is regarded as the 140th anniversary of the first viable electric car. Prouve, who is believed to have driven the world's first electric car, combined a rechargeable battery and a cycle, something very similar to a modern e-bike. The car has a motor to assist you, but you can still pedal at the same time.
So Gustave Prouve, when he combined the electric motor, a rechargeable battery and a cycle very similar to this one, that would be one of the earliest, if not the earliest, electric vehicle to be seen on the roads.
A Victorian cycle engineer built the vehicle in North Yorkshire, England. It took him some 2 months to come up with the replica with materials that closely match those used by Prouve himself. Like the original, it has an average speed of approximately 16 kilometers per hour. NASA's small helicopter has made history as it successfully completed its flight on Mars. Receiving instructions from Earth, Ingenuity managed to rise to about 3 meters, hovered for 30 seconds, and then landed on the red planet. The mission marked the first powered, controlled flight on another planet. The helicopter weighs only 1.8 kilograms, has 4 legs, and is powered by solar panels. Flying a helicopter on Mars is hard because there is not much air to push against to generate the necessary lift. A creative artist in Belgium has come up with an alternative to the face masks, a portable oasis. Alain Vercheron says the mini greenhouse allows him to connect with people while observing social distancing during the coronavirus pandemic. However, the idea is not new. It came to his mind 15 years ago, inspired by the lush oasis he encountered while working in Tunisia.
An oasis is a place of calm, tranquility, cool and well-being in the desert. Here, the fact of having an oasis containing medicinal plants means I am also protecting myself from harm coming from the outside, just like I could at an oasis in the middle of the desert.
Doesn't that look bizarre? Well, he says he has asthma and breathing with the device is easier than a face mask. The 61-year-old artist hopes his invention also raises awareness of environment protection. Pumas are solitary animals that do not usually get along well with humans. However, a Russian family has been living with an extraordinarily friendly mountain lion for 5 years. Now, Alexandra and Maria Dmitriev bought little Messi from a zoo 5 years ago. The cat could barely walk then. With the tender care of the couple, he soon regained his strength. Messi's growth was stunted due to his malnutrition. Interestingly, the adorable puma has never shown any aggression toward humans. Well, looks very friendly. Messi's family has converted their home to meet his natural needs. They have also set up social media accounts for him on Instagram and YouTube, where he has millions of followers.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Malaysian farmers tap classical music and massages to grow one of the world's most expensive fruits, Japanese muskmelons. The farmers believe the method is the best way to grow Japanese muskmelons in Malaysia's hot tropical weather. They regularly rub the melons with a soft cloth or glove. That's a practice, the farmers say, enhance the melon's flavor. To stimulate their growth, classical music is played in greenhouses. And now, all these efforts have paid off following constant trials. The farmers are finally selling their prized luxury fruits of labor on the market.
April is usually marked by multi-day festivities across much of Southeast Asia, including Myanmar, as they observe the Buddhist New Year. The traditional New Year in Myanmar this year began on Tuesday with five-day celebrations known as Tengyan. The occasion is usually celebrated with prayers, ritual cleaning of Buddha images in temples, and public water splashing on the streets. They think water can wash their souls and all evil deeds. People also flock to temples with traditional pots containing flowers and receive blessings from monks. But typically, joyous period of celebration is looking very different this year amid coronavirus and political crises in Myanmar.
A dozen lucky penguins have been returned to the wild after rehabilitating from malnutrition and anemia. The Magellanic penguins waddled back happily into the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Argentina. They were distressed, malnourished, and dehydrated when they were found by conservationists. Some of them had lost their plumage due to malnutrition, but they recovered their feathers after receiving special nutrients. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million Magellanic penguins in the world. The cute birds are named after Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan. They are mostly found around Argentina and Chile. People in Britain are marking the easing of lockdowns implemented to curb the coronavirus pandemic. Words like freedom, hope, family, reunion, and relief have been projected on the walls of the UK's most iconic landmarks, as well as shops and department stores to show people's feelings. A British company commissioned a survey to find the words that best summed up people's feeling after months of lockdown began to be lifted on Monday. Those celebrating the event say reunion is the word that can best express their feelings.
The most powerful word in there for me is reunion. We've all been apart from each other, friends, loved ones, colleagues who are also loved ones, I suppose, in some cases, and really looking forward to getting back to my friends and family that I haven't seen for a long time, and imagine a lot of the British public are too.
The event comes as the UK has been the worst hit nation with a pandemic across Europe. The country saw a staggering number of infections and deaths for months. This prompted authorities to impose restrictions in an effort to bring the pandemic under control.
IRIB English Radio.